Hello everybody, I'm George from Ireland, and behind me is Gray's Monument in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, which is close to his home and to a constituency he represented in Parliament for many years. So I won't read the whole of this out for you right now. But anyway, so he's best known as being Prime Minister, 1830 to 34, and indeed the one behind the Great Reform Act of 1832. So that's why it's called Lord Grey of the Reform Bill. So Charles Grey, got it right, is born in 1864 into a very political family. The Grey family have been prominent here in northeast England for centuries. They already had a peerage, and they're associated with the Whig Party. But he's unusual in as much as his surname Grey and his title were the same, Earl Grey, not Earl of a place. So you can see it's an obelisk. It's 41 metres tall, and there's a statue of him 4 metres tall right at the top. And so people donated to build this. They were so eager to express their gratitude to him. And it was built in his lifetime, because he lived on into the 1850s. This is built 1837 to 38, completed in 11 months. It's astonishing how fast they could build things then with more primitive technology we've got now. I suppose they didn't have all those judicial reviews. So, and there's Grey Street, which is on part of the pedestrian area of Newcastle-upon-Tyne. So he grew up at Howick Hall near here, spent a lot of time at Faladon, and indeed his great-great-grandson was another Grey, Edward Grey, of Lord Grey of Faladon, was the Liberal Foreign Secretary at the outbreak of the First World War. Many people thought it ought to have been Prime Minister. Okay, but back to our Charles Grey. He went to Eton, inevitably, and then Trinity College, Cambridge, probably the grandest college there. So it's a very wealthy family. So his father was later raised to the peerage as Earl Grey. Otherwise, R1 wouldn't have inherited it because his father was not the eldest son. Okay, so going on, he went on the grand tour around France and Italy and so on, and was back here before the French Revolution broke out. But he was a reforming bent, because the two major parties at the time were the Tories and the Whigs, and there wasn't that much difference between them. I mean, the Whigs wanted to perhaps reduce discrimination against dissenters, as in Protestants outside the Church of England, so Baptists, Quakers, Methodists and so forth, whereas the Tories might have been a bit more lenient towards Catholics or whatever. They're both monarchists, they're both Hanoverians. The Whigs might have agreed to a measure of reform, but some of the conservative Whigs were really just as conservative as the Tories, and some of the very liberal-minded Whigs were almost revolutionary. So there's quite a broad spectrum. Remember, there's no manifesto back then, and there was no official list of members. He didn't pay to join. Anybody who was a Whig, who called himself a Whig, but he was an ally of Charles James Fox. So the Napoleonic Wars broke out. I mean, he'd not been completely opposed to the French Revolution, Earl Grey, but he disliked the way that the government at the time, that Pitt the Younger, was used as an excuse to abridge people's liberties, to broaden the definition of treason, to quash all dissent and so forth, to suppress free expression. He opposed some of the treason trials. So a bit like Pitt the Elder had said, this necessity, this is the yelp of slaves or whatever, it's the excuse of tyrants, that we have to do it, we don't have to do it. What are we fighting for? And it was thought that the hostility towards Napoleon was overdone, that perhaps there should be a negotiated peace. Now, he'd wanted to do something for popular rights from 1792, introducing a reform bill to extend the franchise. He didn't believe that every man should have the right to vote. Remember, about 5% of men had the right to vote. And it depended on the constituency, because the medieval legislation would say in Latin, the best men shall choose from among you, you know, 2 knights from each shire, 2 burgesses from each borough. And so every county had 2, regardless of population. And of course, places had big populations in the Middle Ages, in the 13th century, when the first Parliament of England started meeting on a regular basis, and had a very small population by the late 18th century and vice versa. I mean, it's a very minor reform that the Yorkshire Association had got done, giving Yorkshire more members of Parliament. But there were tiny places with, only a handful of people. There were rotten boroughs. There were, with almost nobody living there, there were pocket boroughs effectively controlled by the landlord, who'd sack you or evict you if you didn't vote for his preferred candidate, and so forth. It was not democratic. Most of the establishment of democracy is a very, very bad thing. This had led to the French Revolution and so forth, and most people were too ignorant. Well, that is true, they were. But anyway, the wealthy had the right to vote, and they did it for themselves. There were some constituencies in which most men had the right to vote. Sometimes the right to vote depended on owning certain properties or renting properties of a particular value. It varied enormously. Charles James Fox is very hypocritical, elected for Midhurst and Sussex, which was a pocket borough, just because one of his political allies made sure the people there voted for him and dare not vote against. So, but Earl Grey didn't manage to get this passed. The Tories were dead against, saying that the Constitution was like an organism, and although they had to recognise there were some flaws of the Constitution, but if you change one bit of the whole thing would die. Well, the Whigs took a more mechanistic view of the state, saying that if there's a bad part that's rusted or whatever, you can remove it and replace it with a good part, and it will work better. So they thought we shouldn't pretend that the Constitution is the envy of the world. It most certainly isn't. Now, he was an ally of George IV, later the Prince Regent, who was inclined to the Whigs. George IV, not really for political reasons, just because he wanted money, and he detested his father, who was an ardent Tory. Sir Earl Grey also wanted to abolish the slave trade and slavery. So he was in the Ministry of All the Talents and so on, and he became a bit less radical over time. Cut a long story short, yes, he wanted Catholic emancipation, saying that the Catholic minority in Great Britain, majority as we were in Ireland, as we still are in Ireland, should not be discriminated against by law. And so finally that's passed in 1829, actually a Tory ministry under the Duke of Wellington, doing it partly because he feared there'd be a revolution if he didn't do it. But anyway, the Whigs came in under Earl Grey. One thing about Earl Grey is through Brooks, which was a Whig political club, he'd got to know Georgiana, the Duchess of Devonshire, and began an extramarital affair with her. She's married to a very dull man, 10 years older than her, who had few personal skills, but was a luminary of the Whig party. And there she was gambling at the tables in Bath most of the time. You might have seen that film, The Duchess, in which she's portrayed by Keira Knightley. And she had two daughters with her husband. Then she was impregnated by Grey, gave birth to his daughter. And she told her husband, this is not your child. So the child was brought up by Grey's parents in seclusion. In fact, Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, she got to meet her daughter, but was not allowed to tell the daughter, I am your mother. And she died when the girl was in her early teens. Anyway, because that Duchess of Devonshire had her ton, T-O-N, it's not pronounced ton, as in her social set, used to go to Devonshire House in London on Piccadilly, which unfortunately was demolished in the 1920s, speaking special slang called Devonshire House drawl, as he himself did. So he got that passed, and then 1833, the abolition of slavery. 1807, the transatlantic trade had been abolished. It was no longer lawful to abduct people in Africa and conduct them across the Atlantic Ocean, often utterly inhumane conditions, to toil under the lash in the Antilles or wherever, to treat people as though they're not even human beings at all. The transatlantic trade was abolished in 1807, but slavery itself not till 1833, and not even throughout the whole British Empire. It's been phased out over 5 years. It was brought forward and phased out actually in 4 years. They're supposed to be the apprentice of their masters, prepared for freedom. And to get it passed, because a very powerful and well-funded pro-slavery lobby, they'd even had to pay compensation, not to the victims, but to the perpetrators, the masters. And the biggest single recipient of this £20 million of compensation was the Gladstone family, as in William Ewart Gladstone. His father, John Gladstone, owned plantations in the Bahamas in particular, which is why Gladstone's quite a common surname. Anyway, so that is Earl Grey. And then that tea with bergamot in it was made in his honour. So the so-called Reform Act, the Great Reform Act, is probably called the Representation of the People Act. But there have been lots of them. Representation of the People Act is 1866. Representation of the People Act, 1885. Representation of the People Act, 1918. Representation of the People Act, 1928. Representation of the People Act, 1948. Representation of the People Act, 1983. And so forth. So that's a little bit about Earl Grey with his obelisk there. Right, anyway, thank you for watching my video. Make sure you subscribe on Patreon. Don't know, PayPal, georgecallahan @gmail.com. Another thing to point out is he married a Miss Ponsonby, who was from a landed family in Ireland of Whig inclinations, and they were blessed with a brood of 15 children, so he was very fecund. All right, that was after his liaison with the Duchess. Okay, toodaloo.